This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I just want to say, before we get into this next interview, what you're about to hear is very warm and cozy, vibes-wise, but it does briefly include one description of a grisly act of violence. So I wanted you to know ahead of time. Okay, anyway. Before Bob Mortimer, the comic and author, became Bob Mortimer, the comic and author, he was Bob Mortimer, the Cockroach King, a successful lawyer who represented tenants all over London whose rental units were infested with cockroaches. In fact, Bob Mortimer didn't even try his hand at comedy until his late 20s, when he met a man named Vic Reeves, an established comic who was playing the London club circuit. Soon, the two of them were a double act in the beloved British comedy tradition. Vic and Bob appeared on dozens of television shows, including variety shows and sitcoms, and several of their own programs. Their brand of humor isn't especially topical. It is very silly, joke-heavy, and extremely British.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Is Live! With me, Donald Stott. Now, Now, tonight's victim should be over there just putting our plaster on his hand. So let's go and start him. Come on, Howie.
Pat down the plaster to cover the injury which I recently received from fighting Messerschmitts. Oh, yes, that's the Battle of the Somme.
David!
What? Oh, have you started us yet?
No, I haven't. You know when I've started starting you, because you'll be starting us.
What's that starting us?
David, start! This is Live!
Mortimer paired up with comedian Paul Whitehouse for Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing, a show in which, well, those two comics and old friends go fishing and don't do much else. It is a great show.
I'm gathering my followers. I'm warning my foes to stay put, and I'm celebrating victory. All through the power of the wader.
You finished?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
These days, Bob Mortimer is also a novelist. He just released The Clementine Complex in the U.S. It's his first novel, a mystery story set in South London and loosely based on Mortimer's time as a lawyer. It centers on Gary, a legal assistant who gets roped into a fascinating complex quest after his coworker vanishes. It's a very fun, very funny read. Just an immensely pleasant book. And I'm so excited to have Mortimer on as my guest. Let's get right into it. Bob Mortimer, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show. And I so enjoyed your book, The Clementine Complex.
Thank you very much for having me. And thanks for reading it.
I was disappointed. I think it was called The Satsuma Complex in the UK.
It was, yes, it was.
I'm a real Satsuma enthusiast. I see it as really central to my brand. I have a Satsuma tree in my backyard.
You do?
Yeah. Did someone convince you that Americans don't know what Satsumas were? Or is there
Absolutely. That's what happened, yeah. Which if you've read the book, you'll know it doesn't really matter whether they know, whether you know what a Satsuma is or not. But yeah, they convinced me of that. And I'm not a person who likes to think I know better. You know, it's a different country. So I don't know. That was the advice I was given.
Well, when we put out our own edition of it, you and I can take it back to the Satsuma complex.
Thank you.
Don't worry. I'm a Satsuma influencer. I'll get behind it and we'll make it a smash. So I know that when you wrote your memoir, And Away, it was, you know, from reading interviews with you, a bit of a struggle for you to feel like a real writer, quote unquote. And I wonder how you got from there to feeling like you could write a novel.
Well, I don't think I even now I feel as if I'm a real writer, but I think it was important for my autobiography, because I'd never written a book before, to assume that I wasn't a real writer. And then it would just have my own voice and people could take it or leave it. Because I kind of hadn't realized at the time that, you know, establishing a voice in a book is obviously the important thing. And for my audience here in the UK, it was correct to use my own voice and not the voice of me pretending to be a writer of some sort, you know. And the memoir did amazingly well. I'm over a million sales. It's really taken off. So I thought, well, maybe I can get away with writing another book in the style of someone who doesn't write so well. You know what I mean? You know, it's a style.
I think so. I mean, you could have done what a lot of people who are short on time and long on celebrity do, which is do 15 or 20 hours of interviews with a professional writer and have them write the book. Why did you want to go through the torture of writing it yourself?
I mean, I wasn't given that option, but now you say it, I'm full of regret. it was the circumstance, really, because I wrote it to fill lockdown. When we were locked down, I thought, if I'm ever going to write a memoir, this is the time to do it. And I began to really enjoy the process because I didn't take it too seriously. It's not my career, as it were. And I enjoyed sitting on the sofa. I have a sofa that has a very long squab, long seat. So, you know, you can almost lie on it. But I never really made use of that facility, even though, of course, it cost a lot to get that extra slab of squab on the seat. Right. But it was perfect. And suddenly the sofa made sense. And lockdown made a bit more sense. I was using it to do something that I would never have done otherwise, which I know a lot of people did something similar, but that was my way through lockdown. And I missed it when I stopped. So I thought I'd have a go at a novel.
So when you sat down to write a novel, to write your book, The Clementine Complex, did you have an idea of what kind of book you wanted to write?
When I first sat down, do you know the author Murakami?
Yeah.
I thought I might be able to do something like that. And after just perhaps even less than a day, maybe a couple of days, I realized that I couldn't do a book like that.
An ambitious goal, Bob.
But you have these, I don't know, they're the books I love. So I always wondered whether I could get anywhere near that sort of feeling, that sort of atmosphere that he creates. Realized quickly I couldn't. So sort of returned more to my comedy head. But I was always determined that there would be a story in there that was worth pursuing. And in a previous life, I was a lawyer when I was about 28 years old. As a lawyer, you sometimes use private detectives for serving summonses and various bits and pieces of work. And one of the private detectives that we used took me out for a drink one night and asked me if I would like to join his company, his firm. And he was willing to pay me a lot more than I was earning as a young lawyer. And I was too cowardly to take the job. But I always wondered what would have happened if I had taken that job, because only a couple of weeks after he offered it to me, he was murdered. He was found with an axe in his head in the car park of a pub near where I worked. And it's a very kind of famous, notorious case in this country because there's involvement from the police, from newspaper groups, there's accusations of cover-ups and all sorts. So that was my starting point, just thinking, I wonder what would happen if me, Bob Mortimer, as a 28-year-old, had taken a different path. So I had my voice for the book already because the voice is me. And I had the little scenario, a starting point, because maybe in a different life I would have taken that job and got involved in a very murky kind of underworld, you know?
What was it like when a guy you knew had an axe in his head?
It's a strange feeling. Yeah. It made the work I was doing. I was in a very deprived area of London. I was doing a lot of criminal work. And a lot of housing work, you know, suing landlords and suing the local authorities for substandard housing and cockroach-infested housing and things like that. And finding out that this really lovely lad, this chap, had an axe in his head, made it all very, very real and not quite feel so much of a game, you know, that these criminals that I was representing, you know, there's another level that as their lawyer, you're not aware of, you know. My book is nothing to do whatsoever with that actual case, but I'd just like to have a taking off point. And that was my little taking off point, was if I'd taken that job with this firm of private investigators.
Did you feel as hapless as a young man as Gary seems to be in the novel?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's me trying to imagine how I would deal with those situations. It's me looking at a version of Bob Mortimer that had a little more oomph, you know, had a little bit, was willing to stand his ground, was willing to stand up to people. I never had that. I've never done that. And I just thought that was interesting because I can write it as if I did and try and consider how that would have felt for me. And yeah, so that's kind of interesting because that was my little test, was what would I do if I saw this girl? And of course, I would never have spoken to her. So I was saying, well, sorry, for the purposes of this exercise, you've got to speak to her.
You look visibly uncomfortable thinking about
talking
to her right now. This fictional exercise from a book you've already written, edited multiple times. As soon as you described having to talk to a girl, you started turning sideways.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's I was very, very shy as a young man. And this sort of celebrity I achieved here from when I was in my late 20s, that cured me of a sort of general social anxiousness. But it never cured me of the fear of approaching a lady.
The character Gary has a very lonely life.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that until your late 20s, you had something of the same.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. So it was nice for me, even if only in a novel, to break out from that, because there's a strength in being comfortable on your own, and I can still have fond memories of my times at university as a solicitor, where I was very isolated and so on. I never complain about it; it's fine. But it's frustrating thinking about what could have been if I didn't have that anxiety. So, yes, I suppose there's a bit of therapy in doing it, but not really. It's just when you get to my age, it's nice to look back on your life and consider it seriously and think about the things you did right and the things that you did wrong, you know. The Gary in the book is the version of me that I would like to have been, I suppose.
I mean, he's a bit of a doofus too.
Yeah, but I like
that. Do you aspire to that part?
No, that's fine by me. That's fine by me. He's a good lad. He's not going to bother anyone. He's not going to cause anyone any heat. He's not going to steal from anyone. He's not going to beat anyone up.
It's an interesting thing to aspire to when writing a version of yourself for a crime novel. Like, I feel like mostly if we're going to turn some portion of ourselves into a hero for genre fiction, it's mostly like, what would it be like if I was really good at riding horses and shooting guns? Or like, what would it be like if I was always leaping into dangerous situations? Not what would it be like if I would never steal from anyone?
Yeah, but I wouldn't be an authentic voice then, Jesse. Do you know what I mean? That wouldn't be an authentic voice for me, doing it that way. It's funny enough, probably the most successful TV show I've done in the 34 years of doing TV shows is the one I'm doing at the moment, which is a show where I go fishing with another British comedian called Paul Whitehouse. And, you know, we film us having very ordinary, dull days. And Paul and I have kind of come to the conclusion that maybe the biggest achievement you can have in life is taking joy from the most ordinary of days, you know. So he's a doofus, but he's doing okay.
Even more with Bob Mortimer, still to come, back in a minute. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
This message comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research uncovers emerging trends, then their technology curates relevant stocks into over 40 themes to choose from. Schwab investing themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Visit schwab.com/thematic investing.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, I am talking with Bob Mortimer. He's a comic and actor. He's also half of the beloved British double act Vic and Bob. Besides that, he co-created and co-stars in the wonderful, quiet, hilarious British reality show Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing. In that show, he and comedian Paul Whitehouse go fishing. He's also the author of the new book, The Clementine Complex, which is a fun and funny mystery novel that is in bookstores now. Let's get into the rest of my interview with Bob Mortimer. I have to say, I watched your fishing show on an airplane coming back from London a month or so ago.
Right.
I watched two of them, and I think it is the least that has happened in a television show of any television show I've ever watched.
Yeah. But it's I mean, maybe the lockdown helped it as well, the timing of these things. But it's what I think they call it slow TV, just something unchallenging, rather lovely to look at in your front room. You know, just some gentle, nice company that stops you thinking about the world that we're living in and its troubles, you know. So I could never analyze why that show's worked so well for us, but it's serving some need because it's a big show.
Yeah, see? Get in there, Bob.
Right, thank you so much. Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get out of your way a bit and practice that. But there's fish there, Paul. I felt a couple sniffing at it.
Did you?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Bonne chance, Marie.
Bonne chance to you, Jonathan.
I really liked it too. I want to be clear about that. I was confused at how I liked something so much where there was so little narrative conflict, even jokes. There's not really jokes in the show for a show hosted by two comedians.
Yeah, it was a factual commission. You know, it's not a comedy commission by the BBC. There's a few laughs every now and then in the kind of laughing at old men genre. But, interesting, quite interesting to analyze why a show like that should possibly work. It's something to do with the times because, as you're hinting at, Jesse, it's terrible in some ways. In terms of traditional TV, in terms of entertainment, it hasn't got anything.
I'm sorry to read compliments to you, an English person, but I watched a compilation video of you on the... I guess you'd call it a game show Taskmaster.
All right, where, yes. Yeah.
And this is a show where the hosts of the show ask comedians to accomplish little goals. One of them in this was there was a coconut in a briefcase and you had to make it look like a businessman in 10 minutes. These odd things like this. And the top two comments, the most thumbs up clicked of all of the comments on this video that had millions of views on it were, Bob is the most chaotic good person I have ever seen. Your Dungeons and Dragons alignment, I guess. It's chaotic good. And then the other one is, Bob Mortimer is what you get when a man never questions a single thought in his own head. I bloody love him.
Well, I suppose that's what I've just been hinting at. But it's both for me and Vic, who I started off with, it sounds a bit pompous, really. But that's the way we survived and the way we made progress was by just trying to be certain. If we both laughed when we were writing it, then that was good enough for us. And later on in our career, where we started asking the additional question of, yes, but would other people laugh? The material lost something. We're sure of it. Even though, to be honest with you, it was more successful. But we think it lost something. It lost some of its sort of heart.
I want to play a clip from a Reeves and Mortimer bit. Yeah, I presume it's a specific thing in the UK, but I gathered it to be the sort of idea of a fancy food show. And this is the two of you reviewing alcohols. And it's just you sitting at a table with two big bottles of liquor and like an airplane pack of peanuts. And also at some point, a giant man holding a small baby walks by. Let's take a listen.
New balls, Derek.
Right, new balls we tried this week was this lovely pint of balls here. Let's have a look at colour of that. That is nice brown balls.
Nice, Mr. Brown balls. Nice.
What would you have with that, Derek? Chester, I'd have peanuts with it. Let's have a look at some peanuts here. In contrast, lovely, look at that. Nice brown nuts. Next to it, nice brown balls.
Hey, got any balls for a baby?
You can't give a baby balls.
Just yelling stuff.
I mean, you know, it has got a following, Jesse. You know, it's...
I know.
There are people who adore it.
I'm laughing right now, Bob. I mean, the things that strike me about it that seem reflective of what you're doing and aren't necessarily... They're not really Three Stooges things. They're not really Python things exactly. It has all of the kind of unhinged energy of... the Three Stooges. Like, there are some Python things that are like that, but a lot of Python things are really tightly controlled.
Hmm.
And this feels like it could go off the rails at any moment. And it also is clearly just a function, like substantially a function of you guys liking the sound of the word booze pronounced bows. And like
booze, yeah,
just yelling that a lot.
Yeah.
And then one of you guys, like in a writing session, raising your hand and being like, "What if we said baby bows?"
You can't give a baby booze, Jesse. You can't do that. Yeah, it's always been very a bit divisive, our humor, but. Yeah, it's just that I think that's the nature of our process, you know, of not taking that extra step of trying to decide whether other people will like it. Yeah, I like all that old stuff.
I'm going to play another little bit. And this one it's another pretty simple setup, which is that you are on stage and you look like your foot is caught in like a bear trap kind of thing. And you're crying out. So let's take a listen.
Help. Help.
What's the matter?
Is it not obvious?
Actually, it's not.
Help. Help.
Look, don't think of me in any way callous or indifferent, but I can't actually say what the problem is.
Vic, do you want me to spell it out for you?
I wouldn't mind.
Well, I will then. This cuff button here is dangling on a very, very thin thread. Any moment now, it could potentially drop off.
What? No!
Yes.
No!
Yes.
No!
Yes.
No!
Now he moves. Now he moves.
Again, just the sheer... amount of silly voice and yelling for this premise.
Yeah.
It is a very, it's a wonderful, very slight premise.
It's as slight as a mouse's handbag, yes. It really is. But no, I mean, yeah, but it's fun. It's very traditional comedy, really, just like, you know, undermining your expectations. And my foot's in a bear trap, but my problem is my button's falling off. But, you know, we did it with great belief and and passion. And, yeah, I don't know what to say, really. I enjoy them, and it's nice to hear them again.
Your career went from, as we would say in the States, 0 to 60 when you and Vic Reeves partnered. You did not have a career before the two of you met up and started doing comedy together. And, you know, you were a big deal on television within a couple of years of partnering.
Yeah.
Was it hard for you to, I guess, understand and value your own contributions, since that line in your life was so clear and had everything to do with this partnership?
To value my own contribution. Yeah, no, I didn't value it a great deal at the beginning, because from my point of view, Vic Reeves, the lad I doubled up with, he is the UK's greatest ever comedian, for me, without a shadow of a doubt. I had this awful job, this ordinary life going on as a solicitor that just, you know, I could see another 40 years of this terror. And he dragged me out of that. So no, I just felt like, you know, a contributor, just incredibly lucky to be there. It's nice to come into a comedy career. I'm very grateful that I did have another career beforehand, just so I could, you know, just to really appreciate how lucky I was to be living that life, you know, when I'd been doing a 7 day a week, 9 till 5 job. But no, I was very grateful for that. Later on, and me and Jim have spoken about it, I realized that it was very important for him to have me there to unlock various aspects of Vic Reeves. So I'm very proud of my contribution then. But you're right to say, no, I didn't particularly value my contribution for the first 2 years at all, to be honest with you. I thought I did okay, backed him up, you know, as a good wingman. But on reflection, I think I was playing quite an important role. So I looked back on those days very fondly. And I was with Jim the other day, laughing with him. And yeah, we said similar things to each other that, you know, like, we were good back then, really. You know, we were all right. We did good.
There was this documentary maybe 15 years ago on public television here in the States about your show of shows and Caesar's Hour, which was this show that was on American television in the early 50s, one of the first big comedies on American television. And famously, the writers on this show were Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and Neil Simon and all of these legendary geniuses, right? And the star of the show was Sid Caesar, who in some ways, this was the peak of his career. He was an alcoholic and a real jerk. In a lot of ways. But like, one of the things that I remember from watching that is Sid Caesar was such a powerful performer physically. Like, so he was physically large and big and specific, like could hit things hard. It wasn't just wild nonsense. And all these little nebbishy comedy legends, Carl Reiner, a big guy too, but it was almost like they all took comfort in him as their giant comedy dad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there was something in there that reminded me of you ending up in this show with Vic Reeves, who's a lot bigger than you, has a big presence, and the two of you are making these huge choices comedy-wise. And he's professionally your big brother, right? Because he's the one that said, you come on stage with me.
Yeah.
That there's like some comfort in that bigness.
Yeah. No, I was kind of, you know, like, yeah, hiding under his cape, you know, just fueling what he was doing. It's like, I mean, he had all the skill sets that I didn't have. He was confident. He was loud. He could do it. He could walk the walk. You know, I could think about it, but I would never have done it. But under his wing, I did it, you know, and talking, performing in front of an audience is very different from approaching an individual. But that was a gift. That was a big step for me performing, you know, in front of an audience, and took me a step nearer to being able to just talk to people generally, you know, on a one-to-one basis. But yeah, he was kind of like, yeah, my dad, my big brother's right. Yeah, like yeah, my big, daft, funny brother who'd look after me. And if I did what he needed me to do, everything would be all right.
I just came back from touring with my friend and colleague, John Hodgman. And on the show we do together, I'm very much the second banana. And once in a while, someone will ask me how I feel about being the second banana. Like, don't you want to be the star of the show or whatever? And the like real truth about it is that it is so much easier and more comfortable to be the second banana.
Yeah.
Like, I have a little brother, big brother relationship with John to some extent. And like, I think what a joy it is to be up there on stage and know that if something goes wrong, it's probably his fault.
Probably. Yeah. No, I agree.
And that if I do something good, it's like a bonus.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it's, there's a weird sort of alchemy that is that the kind of the junior partner is often the one that subtly over time gets more embraced by the public, which is weird. It is not done deliberately, but it kind of happens. But I agree with you. I've been asked that so many times over the years. And I've said, no, I really love being the sidekick. I always used to be called the sidekick. But whenever I said it, I didn't know whether it's because I was lacking conviction and I was lying, but I always felt like nobody believed me. Now I'm at the front of it. I know I was right. 100% is much better.
Did you want a comedy career for yourself?
Absolutely not. I was the least likely person I can imagine to have ever got up on a stage. And when I was working as a solicitor, I didn't know anyone in London. It's a big old place to be on your own, you know. And by chance, I went along to this comedy night. And it's a revelation. It was an extraordinary show, the Vic Reeves Big Night Out, a quite extraordinary, where's this come from? This show, this new, I mean, nothing's new, but it felt like a completely new type of comedy. So that became like my life, really. That's the only thing I had outside of my work. And it was just a tiny thing. I'm just talking audiences of maybe 7 the first time I went, maybe 20, maybe maximum 35 people. You know, that's all it was. So it was just like a little friendship group that I'd wandered in on, and they were quite receptive to me. We were all from the same part of the country up in the Northeast. And yeah, maybe Jim saw something in me. I don't know. Maybe he saw something in me, but he started asking me to come up and do stuff. But when we were offered a television series, all I did was take 12 weeks off work. I had fully intended to go back to being a solicitor, you know, and I thought, but I can't, you know, I can't resist the idea of doing a TV show for 12 weeks. But I never went back. I never reclaimed my little briefcase that I used to keep my papers in.
We'll wrap up with Bob Mortimer after a quick break. Keep it locked. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
I'm Jordan Cruciola, host of Feeling Seen, where we start by asking our guests just one question. What movie character made you feel seen?
I knew exactly what it was.
Clementine from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Joy Wang / Shobu Tupaki.
That one question launches amazing conversations about their lives, the movies they love, and about the past, present, and future of entertainment.
Roy in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
I worry about what this might say about me, but I've brought Tracy Flick in the film Election.
So if you like movies, diverse perspectives, and great conversations, check us out.
Oof, this is real.
New episodes of Feeling Seen drop every week on MaximumFun.org.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Bob Mortimer. He's half of the double act Vic and Bob, and the author of the new novel, The Clementine Complex. You described yourself as being okay being on your own and having that be a skill and a gift. But I also feel like, you know, you had very real, serious loneliness in your young life. Your father died unexpectedly when you were very young.
Yeah.
You and your mother, not that long after that, had sort of financial ruin because your house burned down. You ended up separate part of your childhood as your mom tried to get things back together. You said you did not have friends in law school. Like, you really didn't have friends.
I really didn't.
You describe it, right? And you had a thing that you had dedicated your life to previously, which was that you played soccer or football very seriously, and had been sort of told at 16 by the club team for which you played, yeah, this is the end of the line for you, Ace.
Yeah.
And that was like the one thing that you had poured your life's energy into.
Yeah. Yes, that was what I was going to be. My place in the world was defined by my skills as a football player.
And so, like, I don't know if I believe how okay you say you were being by yourself, but I might be wrong. I don't know. Is that real? Well, like, were you really okay?
Well, it's interesting. I was okay for sure, but yeah, of course I always, you know, from as a young boy in a playground, looking over to the group that was having fun, to university, looking over to the people in a bar maybe, or who were obviously part of a, I probably wished I was over there with them. But I never equated the loneliness with unhappiness, I don't think.
You did have some major depression as a young man too.
I did. I was, who knows, but I was just getting along, doing my work in my little student accommodation. And God, it's hard to remember why, but I took a tab of LSD, which is unbelievably unlike me. I'm not someone who had had any contact with drugs or anything, but this happened and I took it. For the next day, from waking up for, I think, something like maybe 4 to 5 years, yeah, I had really bad depression, you know, on medication and so on. So I always blamed it at that time on that LSD tablet. Truth is, there was probably a lot more to it than that. But at the time, I put it down to, you know, to a blip that had caused in my brain's chemistry.
Was it comfortable or uncomfortable when you went from your one thing being going to a comedy show once a week that 12 people were in the audience for, to being a famous person with a television show 2 years later?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it might not even have been 2 years. I can remember at the time there was an awful lot of political stand-up comedy. That was the comedy in the UK at that moment in time. And we went from this little club in a pub to the TV in terms of it being commissioned, probably in less than a year, to be honest with you. And there was quite a few people at the time on the circuit at the time who really resented us for that. But you had to have seen the show, and you had to kind of understand. I understand now how TV works. You know, there was something new. So, yeah, I realize now, of course, producers started sniffing around it and TV channels. So we never felt too bad about it because, yeah, they came to us. We didn't go to them. You know, the thought of this stupid show being on television, it wouldn't even enter your mind, you know. But I realize now, of course it would. It would enter the mind of the TV companies, you know.
But what about the experience of it? Did you feel, it was obviously, I'm sure it was super exciting, but did you feel safe and comfortable in this just whole new way of living your life?
It didn't feel so different. I just had this massive sort of weight of gratitude surrounding me. that I didn't have to do this awful, pursue this awful career that I'd chosen for the rest of my life. That's my main memory of that time. That's like not the fame or being interviewed or, hey, we're on telly. It was just waking up every day and saying, I am not going into this lawyer's office today.
Are you telling me that you were happy to leave behind your life as a celebrated cockroach lawyer?
I was very up, and I'm very grateful to it. As I say, I'm very grateful for that. It's like I had a triple heart bypass, and I've maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and I have a lot of gratitude for that as well, as to the wake up call that it was, and to making me appreciate and make use of the time that I had left. And like similarly with my legal career, I've never lost that gratitude for leaving it behind. And I, you know, a lot of my contemporaries, an awful lot of in this country, the comedians, that's all they've ever done. They started on the circuit when they were 17, 18, 19. And I think it messes them up. That's what I see.
You do seem to regard your career with a sort of combination of placid gratitude and maybe the slightest bit of, I don't know, bemusement or something like that. And that's not something that a lot of entertainers can muster.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because if that's true, it's like that I had no ambitions in that respect for fame or for to be on a stage. I'm well aware that I entered it under the sort of on the shirt tails of Vic. I've never found it a great effort. I'm not saying that anything I've ever done is of any particular merit, but I've never found it an effort to do what I do. With a lot, when me and Jim did live stuff, when I do live stuff now, even the sketches that some of them that you've played, we don't know absolutely what we're going to say. We just know the attitude we're going to be taking to the little scenario. As I say, it's always felt a bit effortless. So, you know, you can't get grandiose about it. It's just what we do. And then it ain't no big deal. I like all the old stuff we've done. And I like the book, because the book was such a surprise that I suppose every author fears this, but I thought that it would be ripped to shreds, you know, because it's not a literary work, but it wasn't. People took it for what it was and enjoyed just listening to my voice in the book. So that's nice that my voice did okay for me. You know, that's 58 years worth to get my voice to there, and people found it reasonably pleasing. So that's, you know, I'll call that a little achievement.
Well, Bob, I'm so grateful to you for taking the time, and I really enjoyed reading the book. There was a lot of real classic me laughing out loud and then yelling at my friend across the room, hey, 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 listen to this sentence.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you.
So I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. It was nice to get to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Thank you. And all the best for the future.
Bob Mortimer, his new book, The Clementine Complex, is available in bookstores everywhere and at bookshop.org. Mortimer and White House Gone Fishing is also a terrific, just absolutely lovely television show. You can watch that on YouTube. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. I'm still working from a little bedroom in the front of my house, but I'm moving to a shed in out behind my house, and my friend Stefan was nice enough to let me come over to his house and check out projector screens. Stefan knows everything about projector screens. Pretty soon I'm going to be watching screener movies on a real screen. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Welcome to our new Maximum Fun production fellow, Daniel Huesillas, who just joined us this week. We get booking help from Merritt Davis. Our interstitial music is by our pal Dan Wally, aka DJW. Our theme music is called Huddle Formation. It was written and recorded by the Go Team. Thanks to the Go Team, thanks to their record label, Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on Instagram at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. We are also on Twitter and YouTube and Facebook. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Whether you're planning a weekend away or an international adventure, All Trips Annual Travel Insurance can protect every trip you take for the next 365 days. Get a quote at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.